Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 59.
We're catching up with Tripitaka and the crew Wukong, Baji, Xiaomeng.
Right. And they've really hit their stride, haven't they? The source says they've basically overcome their internal conflicts, got everyone focused.
Yeah. All united, pushing west.
Yeah.
You get this real sense of progress.
And, you know, time flying by. Oof here. That classic time flies like an arrow feeling. Summer's gone. It's definitely autumn now.
And the description of autumn is just beautiful, isn't it? Thin clouds, strong west wind, cranes calling, frosty woods.
It paints a perfect picture. Crisp, clear, ideal traveling weather, you'd think.
You absolutely would. But, well, here comes the curveball from the source.
Yeah.
Despite this gorgeous autumn setting, suddenly it gets hot.
Yeah, really hot.
Tripitaka feels it straight away. He pulls up his horse like, hang on, it's autumn. Why is it so hot?
This isn't just, you know, a warm spell. It's oppressive. And what's interesting is the obstacle isn't a monster this time.
No, it's the air itself. It's the environment.
Exactly. And you see the team dynamic instantly. Who speaks first?
Oh, Baji, naturally. With the theory, that is. Well, it's something else.
Chuckles lightly. You got to give him points for creativity, though. He's convinced they've reached this place, Sihali.
Yeah, where the sun supposedly sets in the Western Sea.
And his logic is, okay, sun hits water, makes a boiling sound, right? So the king there has people beat drums to protect the kids from the noise.
Quite a leap.
Wukong's reaction is priceless. Just bursts out laughing, tells him, stop talking nonsense.
Right, he points out Tripitaka's usual pace, you know, stopping and starting.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't reach Sihali in three lifetimes.
It's pure Wukong just cutting through the absurdity.
And Xiaomeng steps in, always the voice of reason.
Yeah, he suggests maybe it's just, you know, unseasonable weather, autumn acting like summer.
Which, on the surface, seems plausible.
Yeah.
But the source quickly shows us it's much more specific than that.
Right, because while they're standing there arguing about the heat, they spot a village right there by the road.
And this village, the color is striking.
Everything is red. The source really hammers this home. Red tiles, red walls, red gate, even the furniture inside, red lacquer.
Just completely red. It connects visually to the heat, doesn't it? Makes it feel more tangible.
It really does. It's like the heat is baked into the very place.
So Wukong decides they need info. But first, he has to look presentable.
Which is always funny. Puts away his staff, straightens his clothes, tries to look all scholarly.
Putting on airs before knocking.
And this old man comes out. The description of him is so vivid in the text.
It really is. Layered clothes, bamboo staff, worn shoes.
And that face. Like red copper, white silk beard, long eyebrows over green eyes, gold teeth when he smiles. Very memorable.
The elders, initially startled, calls Wukong a strange person.
Can't blame him, really.
But Wukong quickly explains, we're pilgrims from the east, heading west. Just a bit confused by this heat.
And the elder relaxes, apologizes, you know, my old eyes didn't recognize you, welcomes them in.
They get invited in, offered tea, food,
yeah,
the usual hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
And Tripitaka, very politely, brings up the main question again. Sir, why is it so hot here when it's autumn?
And boom, the elder gives it to them straight. This place is called Flame Mountain.
Flame Mountain, okay.
No spring, no autumn, always hot, year-round heat.
So it's not just weird weather. It's the defining feature of the place. And it's a serious barrier.
Oh, absolutely. The elder says it's, what, 60 liters away? But the fire range itself is 800 liters.
800. And the ground's scorched. Nothing grows.
And if you try to cross, forget it. Even if you had a copper head and an iron body, you'd just melt. Turn into juice.
The graphic.
It really emphasizes the impossibility. This isn't something they can fight or trick their way through. It's just pure, overwhelming heat.
And the source says Tripitaka is just stunned, utterly alarmed, silent. He sees no way forward.
Yeah, it's a real showstopper. But right then, as they're absorbing this awful news,
someone else shows up, a young guy outside, selling cakes.
From a red cart, naturally, keeping the theme going.
Wukong, ever practical, decides to buy one. Uses one of his transformed hairs as a coin. Classic Wukong.
But the cake itself, it's another sign of the extreme heat.
Oh, yeah. The description's intense. Steaming hot. Wukong takes it and it's like holding,
Like glowing coals in a brazier, like red hot nails in a stove. That's straight from the text.
Even Wukong is juggling it, yelling, hot, 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 hard to eat.
It's kind of funny, but it really drives the point home. This heat affects everything.
And the seller just shrugs it off. If you don't like heat, don't come here. This is how it is.
Total acceptance. But Wukong's sharp. He picks up on a contradiction.
Right. He asks the key question. There's that saying, grain won't grow if it's too hot or too cold.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's this hot and nothing grows, where'd you get the flour for this cake?
Brilliant question, and it gets the answer they need.
The seller says, if you want to know about the flour,
respectfully seek the Iron Fan Immortal, Tai Shan Shan.
The Iron Fan Immortal. And she has a special item, right? The banana fan.
Exactly. The Charakir banana fan, and its power is tailor-made for this problem.
First fan puts out the fire, second brings wind, third brings rain.
And that's how the locals manage to grow grain and survive.
Oh.
Without that fan.
Nothing. Not even a blade of grass.
So the solution isn't about their own power. It's about getting this external magical tool.
From a specific person, this changes the game completely.
It really does. Wukong gets it immediately, goes back inside, gives Tripitaka the still burning cake, tells him not to worry.
Then turns straight to the elder. No more pleasantries.
Nope. Cuts right to it. Elder, never mind the tea. Where does the Iron Fan Immortal live?
The elder tells him. Queen Mountain, Southwest. Banana Cave.
Simple enough address, but then comes the catch.
Yeah, getting the fan isn't easy. The locals only go once every 10 years.
10 years, and when they do, it's a major production. Specific gifts, pigs, sheep, silk, wine.
Four pigs, four sheep, all this stuff. Plus, they have to purify themselves, be really pious. It's a whole ritual.
It shows this immortal isn't just handing out favors. There are serious conditions attached.
And the journey itself.
Yeah.
The elder lays it out. It's a month-long round trip.
Over 1,400 line through dangerous, empty land.
He tries to warn Wukong. Take food. Take companions. Don't treat this lightly.
Don't treat it like a game.
But Wukong, he hears 1,400 line and just laughs.
Typical Wukong. No big deal. I'll pop over and be right back.
Doesn't need food. Doesn't need company. Just waves it off.
And poof, he's gone. Vanishes into thin air.
Leaving the poor elder standing there stunned.
Realizing, oh my god, he's actually a divine being who rides clouds.
So Wukong's off on this sudden, urgent side quest. With him landing on this place, Queen Mountain. He's looking for a cave, but then he hears something.
The woodcutter.
Yeah, a woodcutter. But he's not just chopping wood, he's reciting a poem. It gives the scene a certain kind of weight, you know?
It does. Feels a bit like fate intervening, almost.
And this woodcutter, he's not just background noise. He's actually the source of Wukong's first real lead. Wukong asks him about a banana cave and an Iron Fan Immortal.
And the woodcutter, his reaction tells you something's up. He laughs, right? Yeah. And corrects Wukong.
Yeah, he says, well, there is a banana cave, but it belongs to the Iron Fan Princess, who's also called Rakshasa.
So Wukong's probably a bit confused, but he presses on. Does she have the fan? The one that can put out the fire.
And the woodcutter says, absolutely, that's the one. He even calls her a saintly being and says the fan is like this amazing treasure that protects everyone locally from the heat.
Okay, crucial info. But then comes the real kicker.
Right. The woodcutter just drops this fact.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, she's the wife of the great strength Bull Demon King.
Ooh, and Wukong's reaction in the text is immediate and pretty strong. That phrase, decha.
Yeah. Greatly turned pale with fright or shock. It's not just surprise.
No. And his thought right away is, Shinna. Basically, oh no, not another enemy, it's personal.
And the text shows us exactly why. That name, Bill Demon King's wife, it instantly connects the dots for Wukong. He remembers dealing with their son, Red Boy.
Right, subduing Red Boy.
And he remembers Red Boy trapping his master, or trying to anyway. Plus there was that run-in with the Bull Demon King's uncle over some water. Another grudge.
Wow. So it's not just one past issue. It's like a whole web of bad history tangled up with this family.
Exactly. And Wukong sees it immediately. His problem is suddenly huge. How on earth is he going to borrow this essential fan from the mother of the kid he fought, wife of his sworn brother, who he also has issues with?
It seems impossible.
And the woodcutter, seeing Wukong's, like, total shock, actually gives some surprisingly practical advice.
Which is?
He says, look, the cave's right over there. Just go ask her for the fan. Focus on why you need it. And this is the key bit. Hey.
Meaning?
Basically, don't bring up the past. Don't acknowledge all that old unpleasantness. Just, you know, act like it never happened.
And easier said than done, especially for Wukong.
Totally. But, okay, he thanks the woodcutter and heads off towards this banana cave.
And what's it like when he gets there? The source gives us a description, right?
Yeah, it's apparently quite beautiful scenery around it, but the cave itself, tightly shut, securely barred, it's clear this is a prized possession, well guarded.
Not exactly welcoming. So how does Wukong approach? Does he take the woodcutter's advice?
Well, maybe partly.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe he tries a different angle. He gets to the gate and calls out, "Brother Bull, he's addressing the Bull Demon King." Maybe trying to use that old sworn brotherhood connection.
Interesting tactic. Does it work?
Well, someone answers. The door cracks open, and it's a servant girl. Described as a sort of a hairier furry girl. Maybe not human, maybe just, well, hairy.
Okay.
She looks normal enough, carrying tools.
Okay, so Wukong talks to her.
Yeah. Greets her politely. Says he's Sun Wukong from the east. Monk on a journey, blocked by the fiery mountain. Gets straight to the point. Huh. I need to borrow the banana fan for just a bit.
Okay, request made. Now the reaction inside.
Oh, it's explosive. The second that servant girl tells Rakshasu, who's at the door, Sun Wukong, and what he wants, the text uses this amazing phrase.
Like salt on fire or oil on fire.
Exactly. Instant fury, pure rage. Her face flushes red.
Yikes. So no calm consideration then.
Not a chance. She immediately calls for armor, grabs two sharp swords. The text even describes her getting ready for battle turban, robe, sash, shoes, swords gripped tight. She is not happy.
And she comes storming out.
Storms out, demands to see him. Wukong steps up, bows, tries the polite approach, calls her sister-in-law.
Uh-oh, bad move.
Very bad move. She just explodes. Who's your sister-in-law? Who wants your bow? It's clear that kinship angle is not going to work. Probably should have stuck with the woodcutters. Don't mention the past plan.
Too late now. She's angry, and she tells him exactly why, right?
Right to his face. How did you harm my son? She blames him, this impudent monkey, for ruining her boy, the Saint Infant King.
So in her mind, he's not here to borrow anything.
No. She thinks he's shown up to basically hand himself over to be killed for what he did to Red Boy.
It's all about her son. Pure maternal fury.
Absolutely. And Wukong, he tries to counter this with, like, facts and logic. He explains, look, your son captured my master. He was going to cook him.
Okay, fair point.
And he clarifies, it wasn't him, it was Guanyin Bodhisattva who stepped in, saved the master, and took Red Boy.
He also explains what happened to Red Boy afterwards, according to the text.
Yes. He describes Red Boy's current situation. He's with Guanyin now, he's the good fortune boy, he's achieved enlightenment. Wukong uses all these terms. Eternal, pure, immortal.
Living as long as heaven and earth?
Yeah, basically saying, he's achieved immortality, this is a good thing, you should be grateful, not angry. He questions her logic.
Makes sense from his perspective, but does Rakshasa buy it?
Not for a second. She doesn't care about enlightenment or immortality. All she knows is her son was taken and she can't see him. That's it.
She dismisses his whole explanation.
Completely. Calls him a clever-mouthed, impudent monkey. Accuses him of just using fancy words to get out of trouble. The emotional core of her grievance is untouched by his logic.
Okay, so reason fails. Yeah. What's plan C for Wukong?
He shifts to negotiation. A direct deal. He says, okay, fine. Lend me the fan first. Let me put out the fire so my master can pass. Then when I bring the fan back, I promise I'll go see Guanyin and bring Red Boy here for a visit.
Seems reasonable. A win-win almost.
You'd think so. He asks her, what could possibly be wrong with that?
But she still refuses.
Flat out refuses. But my treasure isn't something I just lend out lightly. End of discussion on the loan.
Wow. Okay, so no loan. What now? Does she just attack?
Not immediately. Instead, she offers this really weird challenge. She says, okay, monkey, stand still. Let me hit your head with my swords.
Let her hit him.
Yeah. She says, if it hurts you, you definitely don't get the fan. If you can take it without flinching, well, maybe I'll think about lending it to you.
That's unexpected. Does Wukong actually agree to this?
He does, which is kind of amazing. And the text says she goes at it, ping, 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 like whack, whack, whack. More than 10 times she hits his head with her swords.
And Wukong?
Totally unfazed. He didn't even take it seriously. His head's famously hard, right? It does absolutely nothing to him.
So he passes her bizarre test.
He does. And seeing that her swords are useless, Rakshasa gets scared. She tries to back away, get back inside her cave.
But Wukong stops her.
Yeah, steps in front of her like, okay, I took the hits, now where's the fan? Pressing the issue.
And even now, she won't lend it.
Still refuses. After the reasoning, the deal, the test,
yeah. She
still says no.
So that's finally it for Wukong trying to be diplomatic.
That seems to be the breaking point. Diplomacy failed, reason failed, deals failed, even passing her weird test failed. The source says this is when he decides, okay, enough asking. He takes out his own weapon, the staff from his ear.
It's fight time.
It is. Wukong with his staff, Rakshasa with her two swords. And the text explicitly points out this isn't just a random brawl. On Queen Mountain, it says they were hookship.
Not about kinship, only about the feud.
Exactly. The past resentment, the history, that's what's driving this fight now. All that baggage has come to the surface.
And how does the fight go?
Well, the text says they fight fiercely until night starts to fall. And Rakshasa realizes something. Looking at Wukong's defense, the power of his staff, she figures she can't actually beat him in a straight physical fight.
So she needs to change tactics.
Yes. And this is the crucial moment. She decides to pull out the big gun. Or, well, the big fan. The real, genuine banana fan.
The one he came for in the first place.
The very one. And the source gives us a hint of its power. One wave makes ghosts and gods lament. This thing is seriously powerful.
Okay, so she uses it. What happens?
She gives it one wave.
Yeah.
Just one. And it creates this incredibly powerful wind described as a dark wind or yin wind.
And Wukong.
According to the text, that single blast is devastating. He's fanned until he's without shadow or form. He can't hold on, can't resist. He's just blown completely away from the mountain. Gone.
Just like that. One wave.
One wave. And with Wukong literally blown off the map, Rakshasa stands there, victorious for now, and heads back into her cave.
Wukong, tumbling, uncontrollable, like leaves in a storm or, you know, blossoms on water. He can't land.
Just airborne. For how long?
The whole night. Drifting and drifting until dawn breaks.
Wow. An entire night being tossed around. Hmm. Even for Wukong, that sounds disorienting. So where does he finally touch down?
He lands on a mountain, and interestingly, he recognizes it. It's Little Mount Sumeru.
Oh, right. Little Mount Sumeru. He's been there before, hasn't
he? He has, yeah. He went there for help with the Yellow Wind Monster, so it's not totally unfamiliar ground.
And the source mentions the distance, right? Thousands of light. To confirm, this wasn't, like, a short trip.
Absolutely. It specifies thousands of light, confirming he was blown a huge distance away from the Flaming Mountain. This is where Lingji Bodhisattva lives.
Ah, Lingji Bodhisattva. So naturally, Wukong seeks him out.
Makes sense, given his past success there. He goes and explains everything you know, the mountain being impassable, needing the fan, and why the princess is so hostile.
Which is basically revenge, right?
Right.
Because Wukong was involved with her son, Red Boy, becoming Guanyin's disciple.
Exactly. It's personal for her. And this is where Lingji provides some absolutely crucial context. Stuff Wukong couldn't possibly have learned back at the princess's cave.
Okay, so what does Lingji reveal? This sounds important.
Super important. First, he confirms who she is, Rakshasi, the Iron Fan Princess. But then he talks about the fan itself. He says it's no ordinary object. It's a, well, a spiritual treasure. Born right at the beginning of creation, from the essence of the sun itself, up on Kunlun Mountain. Its very nature is tied to extinguishing fire.
Whoa. Okay. From the sun's essence. But it puts out fire.
Yeah.
That's kind of a paradox, isn't it?
It is. And Lingji explains just how powerful this thing is when used on a person, not just fire.
How powerful?
He says it's meant to blow someone 84,000 lines.
84,000. That's astronomical.
It really is. But Lingji notes something interesting. Wukong only traveled about 50,000 line to get to Mount Sumeru.
Huh. So he didn't even go the full distance. Why not?
Lingji attributes it to Wukong's own power, his ability to sort of, well, control clouds to stabilize himself somewhat. Lu Dianjin.
His cloud riding skills.
Basically, yes. Lingji says a normal person, a mortal, would have just kept going the full 84,000 line, no stopping.
So even in getting totally defeated and blown away, Wukong's own abilities kind of limited the damage.
In a way, yeah. But Lingji reframes the whole thing. He tells Wukong this wasn't just a random setback. It's actually part of Tang Sanzang's, you know, destiny, this whole detour. It's necessary for success.
Necessary? How? Does he offer a solution?
He does. He reveals he has something called the wind-fixing pill. Ding Feng Dan.
Wind-fixing pill.
Oh, yeah. A gift from Tathagata Buddha himself, apparently. Lingji says he received it ages ago, but never needed it until now.
And this pill, what does it do?
It makes the wearer immune to the fan's wind, completely unaffected. Lingji gives it to Wukong.
Wow. No. So the key to beating the fan was waiting for him all along, but he had to be literally blown across the continent to find it.
Pretty much. Wukong takes it, obviously grateful. Lingji even helps out by sewing it securely into his collar so he doesn't lose it.
That's thoughtful. and practical.
Very. Then Lingji points him back in the right direction northwest, towards the Rakshasi's place.
Sun Wukong, he's back for round two.
Yeah, and what immediately stands out in the source is the Rakshasa woman's reaction. She seems genuinely taken aback that he's even returned. And especially so quickly. Her fan normally blows people, what, 84,000 lies away?
The moment she sees him, it's straight to confrontation.
They don't talk long.
No.
They fight. And after just, what, 5 or 7 rounds, she decides she's had enough and pulls out the fan.
And here's where it gets really interesting. This is the big twist. She fans him, expecting to send him flying again.
Yeah, that 84,000 Lyle trip.
But this time, he just stands there. Standing firm, completely unmoved.
Precisely. A Dingfeng Dan. A wind-stopping pellet from Lingji Bodhisattva after the first time she blew him away. This pellet completely neutralizes the fan's wind power, at least against him.
That's huge. Learning from defeat, finding the exact key. Okay, so she sees the fan fail. She must be shocked.
Oh, absolutely. She's clearly stunned, and she retreats, locks herself inside her cave. Seems like game over, maybe?
But not for Wukong.
No, he's not giving up that easily. The source describes a really audacious move next.
Yeah. What's the...
Transforms himself into a tiny insect. I'll see if send the text as maybe a little fly or some kind of nymph.
Seriously, a bug? Yeah. To do what?
To slip right through a crack in the door she just locked. He sneaks inside.
Wow. That visual is just wild, shrinking down, sneaking through a tiny gap. Okay, so he's inside. What happens then?
Well, the story says the Rakshasa, you know, after the fight and the shock, she gets thirsty. She asks her attendants for tea.
Okay, tea break.
And that's where the next part of this really unusual plan plays out. He sees his chance. He hides right under the foam on the tea.
No, under the foam.
Yep. And she drinks it down, swallows him whole. He intentionally goes inside her body.
He's inside her. Oh, man. Okay, so does he just wait?
Not for long. He makes his presence known pretty quickly. Transforms back to his normal size, or at least makes himself felt right there in her belly. And then he demands the fan. From the inside.
This completely flips the script. The external fight didn't work. She retreated.
Yeah.
But now he's exerting pressure internally.
Exactly. And the source uses these really vivid kind of graphic descriptions of the pain he causes. It mentions giving her a chamber pot, like pushing down hard, and the snack, like pushing up near her heart. Mm-hmm. It sounds excruciating.
Ouch. Yeah, that definitely sounds effective if... incredibly uncomfortable to imagine. She must be in agony.
Total agony. She's crying out for mercy. And the source notes she actually calls him Sun Uncle. Sure. It's a clear sign of submission, right? Recognition of his power over her in that, well, very vulnerable moment.
So she caves.
She quickly agrees. She'll lend him the fan if he just stops the pain and comes out.
Okay, so the deal is struck. How does he get out?
She tells him to come out through her mouth. He agrees. Transforms back into that tiny insect.
Wait, the bug form.
Flies out of her mouth and lands right on the fan she'd brought out as part of the deal.
He takes it. Does he say anything?
The text says he gives a kind of sarcastic thank you, transforms back, and heads out of the cave. Feeling pretty pleased with himself, you'd imagine.
I bet. He got the fan. Not through force, not really negotiation, but through this incredibly clever and, frankly, invasive trickery after being physically blocked.
And then he goes back to Tang Sun Zhang and the others, and he gives them the full rundown. The fight, being blown away the first time, getting the pellet, the Ding Thing Dan, coming back, resisting the fan, the insect transformation, going inside her with the tea, causing all that pain.
He tells them everything.
Everything. And forcing her to hand over the fan. He also explicitly confirms her identity, wife of the Cow Demon King, mother of Red Boy, connecting all those dots.
So finally... they have the fan. Victory. They can put out the fire, cross the mountain, continue west. Mission accomplished.
You'd think so. Except, well, that's not quite how it plays out, is it?
I don't know. What happens?
They start heading towards the mountain, expecting relief, but the heat is immediate, intense. The source describes Shaxing yelling his feet are burning.
Ouch.
And Baji's complaining his paws are hurting, Chixing, even the horse is struggling. It's still incredibly hot.
Okay, but now they have the fan. The solution.
Right. So he brings out the fan, the object of all that incredible effort, ready to finally extinguish the flames. He fans once. The fire gets hotter.
What?
Hotter!
Yeah. He tries again, fans a second time, it intensifies even more.
Yo!
He gives it one more try, a third fan, and the flames shoot up thousands of feet high, and they actually singe his own hair.
He gets burned. The Monkey King, burned by fire.
He does. The hero, who's supposed to be practically immune to fire, gets scorched by the very fan he went through hell, literally went inside someone to get. He immediately yells for everyone to fall back. They scramble 20 light away just to escape the intense heat.
Wow. So he throws the fan down.
Yeah, he throws it down, totally frustrated. The source quotes him saying something like, "He's not working. I was tricked by that scoundrel." He knows he's been fooled.
And Tang Sunzang must be devastated.
All that.
I hope.
Understandably distraught, yes. And Baji, well, Baji can't resist the jab.
Oh, I bet.
Teases him about being afraid of fire when he's supposed to be fireproof.
Does the story explain why he got burned? It seems odd. It does, actually. It says he usually relies on protective magic, like specific spells or techniques when dealing with fire. But this time, he was so focused on the act of using the fan, on putting the fire out, that he didn't activate his usual defenses.
Okay. So he let his guard down.
Exactly. Left him vulnerable to the fan's opposite effect, intensifying the fire, not extinguishing it.
So they're right back where they started. Stuck. Fire ahead, goal ahead. No fire elsewhere, but no goal either.
A perfect trap. The text describes them debating this very dilemma. West means fire, but also scriptures. No fire means no scriptures. What do they do?
This sounds desperate. Who can help them now?
And right on cue, this is when the land spirit of the Flaming Mountain appears, like a local guide almost. He confirms, yes, the fire is a huge problem, and offers them some food. Basic hospitality.
Okay, but they need more than food. Wukong must ask him about the fire, right?
He does. He asks the spirit point blank, when can this fire possibly be put out? How do we get past this?
And the spirit gives the answer they probably expect.
He says you need the Rakshasa woman's banana fan, the very thing they thought they had.
So Wukong probably says, got it right here, and shows him the fan.
Exactly. He shows the spirit the fan he acquired through all that internal negotiation.
And the spirit's reaction.
According to the source, the spirit just laughs.
Laughs.
Laughs, and then delivers the final crushing blow, which means,
this man is not the real one. You were tricked.
Precisely. The source explicitly states it was a fake, an imitation.
Wow. So all of that, the fight, the wind pellet, the insect trick going inside her, the pain, the deal, it was all for a counterfeit fan.
A counterfeit that actually made the problem worse.
That is incredibly frustrating. What a twist.
It really highlights something important, doesn't it? How information, even gained through extreme measures, even what looks like total success, can still be completely misleading. Getting the authentic tool, or, as we're about to find out, the real connection, is what's critical.
So what now? Is there another clue?
Yes. The land spirit doesn't just leave them hanging. He gives them the next step. He says to get the real fan, the one that actually works.
Yeah.
They must seek out the Great Strength King.
For the Great Strength Bull Demon King.